Welcome to Christ the Center, your weekly conversation of Reformed theology. By my count, this is episode number 838. My name is Camden Busey, and as usual, I'm in Libertyville, Illinois, just outside of Chicago. And I'm delighted to welcome to the program, for the first time, I believe, as a guest on the program, although we've spoken in other capacities in other places, we have Reverend Fred Greco, pastor of Christ Church in Katy, Texas. Welcome, Fred. It's so good to see you today. I'm glad you could join me.
Glad to be with you. Thank you.
It's a big day for us. We are on the heels. It's the morning after the national championship. For people that have been following along the podcast, I've had on accident, this has been in God's providence, but we've had some Michigan fans on the program. And so now we know that Michigan indeed has won the national championship. Last week's episode, they had won the Rose Bowl. And we didn't know how things were going to turn out with Washington, although we were optimistic, maybe more than optimistic. I wouldn't say overconfident, but pretty confident. And so now we're can't be higher in terms of sports enthusiasm. Of course, it's just sports, but you know, we could take our time to celebrate. Fred, how are you feeling about the blue and the maize and blue and Michigan and this historic win? Let's parade our victory in front of all the listeners and make them listen to this for a while, unless they skip.
Well, I know you're going to ask me some questions, Camden, but I've got to start with a question for you.
Sure.
Who's got it better than us?
Nobody. Nobody. That's right.
Yes. You know, it's interesting. The last time that we were in this position, sort of, was 97. And I had just graduated from law school, and I had just become a father. I had one son. And now I'm a pastor, not a lawyer. I have four kids who are grown, two of whom are married, and a granddaughter. And it was a long time coming. So I've been floating pretty high all day. It was good to see. And, you know, I'm old enough to remember that not only was it good to win, it was good to win the Michigan way. Maybe you were doing this as well. I was shouting at the TV, you know, keep running, run it down their throats.
Yeah, I don't stop. My wife keeps shushing me, you know, like it's like, stop, let me have this. Yes. Let me have this.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. So I was a little worried. I was a little worried about doing a podcast today because, you know, there have been a couple Ohio State games in recent years where I've lost my voice because I was yelling so much at the TV and I had to save it to make sure I had enough juice and enough gas in the tank to be able to speak with you today. But I made it. I can talk.
Absolutely.
Yeah, today we're going to be speaking not just about football. It's not about that. Although, oddly enough, your love for the Michigan Wolverines does come into play here in a way because you did attend and graduate from the University of Michigan Law School, a prestigious institution. And that has to do with some of the stuff I'd like to talk about today. We're going to be talking about church order and parliamentary procedure and obviously, things that are of great pertinence and importance to the church, significant spiritual matters, but they do intersect a bit with your legal training. And I'm curious to talk to you about that today. But first off, just maybe I might ask you a leading question. If you might share with us something about your biography. It's not a completely unusual path to the ministry. I mean, it's unusual, but I've heard of other people that have had similar pathways. But I wonder if you might be able to share with us some about your path to the pastoral ministry, at least.
Sure. So I was born into an Italian and Polish household. So you and your listeners will be able to guess from my ethnic heritage that I grew up Roman Catholic. I went to a Roman Catholic grade school, was an altar boy. And as I tell people, one of the jobs of an altar boy is during the sacrifice of the Mass to ring the bell at the appropriate time that the host is transformed, transubstantiated. And so in God's providence, when I was in seventh grade, I was born in Niagara Falls. My parents moved to a place called Grand Island, which is a large freshwater island between Niagara Falls and Buffalo. And I went to a public school. I had originally intended from my youth to become a doctor. And my mother said to me, well, you know, if you're going to be a doctor, you need to know Latin. And so when I was in ninth grade, I dutifully signed up for Latin and started taking classes. And, it, you know, it's interesting. I'm sure you have the same experience. You look backwards and you see every little thing that the Lord has done to bring you to where you are now. You know, just something as silly as a comment like, I want to be a doctor, and my mother wanting to test that and say, well, then you've got to take Latin. That really set me off on a trajectory, because my Latin teacher was the son of a Baptist minister. And he took myself and a few of my friends under his wing. And we used to meet after school and read C.S. Lewis and Shakespeare and Plato and all, you know, Tolstoy and Dostoevsky, all from like a Christian perspective. And so I was exposed to Christianity. I went off to college at the University of Buffalo, which at that time was a Division III school. Now they're a MAC school, but I went off to go to major in pre-med. But one of the things that works for that is you don't need to have a biology major or something like that to be pre-med. So I decided I would major in classics because I really enjoyed Latin. And so my first semester of college was Greek 101, Latin 201, organic chemistry, and the easiest calculus class I could find. About halfway through that semester, I was getting A's in Latin and Greek and struggling in organic chemistry and trying to make it through math. And I was in a lab, and I remember this vividly because I was doing an experiment, and you weren't allowed to touch the test tube because your oils and fingerprints would throw off the weight of the experiment. So I'm holding it in this test tube holder, and after like a couple of hours worth of work, I dropped the test tube. And so I cleaned up my lab materials and walked off to the drop ed office. And that was the end of my medical career. Wound up graduating with a bachelor's in classics and history. And pretty much what you can do with that is go to graduate school,
right?
Which I did. And I went off to the University of Chicago on the south side of Chicago. I was in a PhD program, did that for a couple of years, and was really, really intensely working with Latin and Greek. And again, this is another example of, I wasn't a Christian yet, but the Lord using this. And, you know, I used to kid my fellow seminary students when I was at RTS Jackson. They would complain about having to do like 10 verses of a Pauline epistle. I would say to them, you know, when I was at Chicago, I was reading 20 pages of Greek a day,
mm-hmm.
because that's all we did, right? So the Lord prepared that for me. I was in a PhD program, but decided I didn't want to be an academic. So I got a terminal master's, and I had some friends who were in law school at Chicago, some of whom you would know. One of my friends was the general counsel of Facebook.
Oh.
He was a friend at school, not a good enough friend to share proceeds from that IPO with me, but you know, but a good man, yeah. And some other guys of similar stature. And they convinced me that I could go to law school, and I did. And that's how I ended up at Michigan.
Mm-hmm.
I ended up there because my parents had moved from the Buffalo area to the Detroit area. And so I got in-state tuition and got to be a part of a top 10 law school with great profs. Got to go to the Big House on Saturdays, mm-hmm. be a part of the largest crowd anywhere in America watching a game.
Mm-hmm.
And even the campus is gorgeous. So Michigan has this wonderful Gothic law quadrangle, and it's a good example of lawyers and how they work. So someone gave a massive donation for that. And one of the keys in the contract was you can't build anything in a different architectural style near this quad. And most other law schools in the 50s, 60s, and 70s expanded, right. And they built ugly buildings. Mm-hmm. A great example of that is at Virginia, which is a gorgeous campus with a sinfully ugly law school. Well, anyway, at Michigan, they couldn't afford to build this Gothic large library. So they built the largest natural light underground library in the world. And so was there for 3 years. And it was there that I came to know the Lord. I was traveling back to Buffalo for like Christmas break and summer break, and was still in touch with that original Latin teacher friend of mine. And I had a geometry teacher who was a Christian and eventually became a pastor, and started going to church at his church with my friend. And I asked my Latin teacher friend, what should I study? What could I read? And he recommended the book of Isaiah, and he recommended Matthew Henry. And so I read more Matthew Henry that semester than torts. And the Lord brought me to himself and started that journey. I started out kind of as a dispensational Baptist and then read A.W. Pink's Gleanings in Exodus. That convinced me of the errors of dispensationalism. I mean, I can vividly see it. He's commenting on a passage in Exodus in which Israel says that we will obey the law. And the Lord says, you have well spoken in all that you have spoken. And of course, that's completely contradictory to the dispensational view, which is Israel should have said, don't give us the law. Don't give us the law. We want grace. So I went from dispensational Baptist to Reformed Baptist, kind of Charles Spurgeonite, and kind of bounced around in Ann Arbor at churches. At the time, there was no Presbyterian church. There really weren't Reformed Baptist churches per se. And so in the middle of my law school career, I met my future wife, Deborah, and I used to travel back and forth during the week to Buffalo to see her and be with her and do that. I graduated in 96, and the Lord, through a series of providences, put us in Cleveland, Ohio, where we didn't know a soul. And before we moved and got married, I went and called and interviewed pastors trying to find a Reformed Baptist church. Long story short, couldn't find one. Found a PCA church, Grace Presbyterian Church, where Rhett Dodson is now the pastor.
No, Rhett.
He wasn't the pastor when I went there. Another man you may know, Zach Eswine, was the pastor there. After a few years, he left to go teach at Covenant Seminary, and I believe now he's still an EPC pastor in the St. Louis area. Zach is about my age. And first time I met him, you know, we talked and I said, you know, this is great. I just want to let you know, you're never going to baptize any of my kids because I'm a Reformed Baptist. And, you know, that's just the way it's going to be. Well, we got married in August of 96, moved a couple of weeks later to Cleveland. And in August of 97, our first son, Peter, was born. And I said to myself, you know, I'm in a Presbyterian church. I've got Presbyterian authors all over my bookshelves. I better study this issue.
Right.
And I read literally everything I could get my hands on. And what finally convinced me was Matthew Henry's A Church in the Home. It was a lithograph print from Stillwater Revival's books. I don't know if you remember that.
Sure, yeah.
They printed, but they didn't print books. They printed spiral-bound photocopies of things that weren't published. And so I became a Presbyterian. And was ordained as a ruling elder at the ripe old age of 28 and served there in that church as an elder, as a clerk of session, was very involved in Presbyterianism, even as a ruling elder. I was a chairman of our Presbyterian Candidates and Credentials Committee. I served on General Assembly committees. I used to joke, I secretaried about everything. In 2003, at that point, we had three sons, and my wife was pregnant with our fourth, a daughter. We decided to go into the ministry full-time and left Cleveland to go to Jackson, Mississippi, where I was at RTS Jackson from 03 to 06. Graduated from there, was the last man in my class to find a call because I knew I wanted a preaching position. I didn't want to be a staff person or a youth guy. I wanted to preach every week because while I was in seminary, I was student supply at a little church called Chula Presbyterian Church. Mm. It's well known as being Joey Pipa's first church. Mm-hmm. And Matt Baugh, who was an OPC missionary to Haiti, was in that church. Matt actually was killed in a car wreck Haiti while I was there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. A truck hit him.
Yeah.
And so... graduated and received a call from Christ Church in Katy, which is West Houston. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a suburb of Houston, but right now it's between 500,000 and 600,000 people. So it's bigger than Pittsburgh and a lot of Midwest cities.
Well, you like to do everything big in Texas. You know, even the suburbs are huge.
Exactly. I tell people that there's a war on grass here in Katy. They're, you know, they just build and build and build and build. And so that was now, you know, more than 17 years ago. And so I was an elder for about 10 years before that. But this is the only place I've been a pastor or a teaching elder. I was called as a senior pastor. There was an associate pastor here, John Carroll, who's a dear friend and now lives and is retired in Virginia. And the Lord has just been very, very gracious to us. You know, he has paved the way. I mean, it's, again, little things that you see. So one of the first things I did was I sat on at a building committee meeting because we owned land but didn't have a building. And because the type of lawyer I was a corporate real estate finance lawyer, I negotiated our first mortgage with the bank, saved us maybe 20 grand because that's what I did. Yeah, right. So that worked out well. Uh-huh. And I have just been blessed to be here. Three of our four are still in the Texas area. My son, Peter, is here in Katy. My third son, Paul, is in the Dallas area. My daughter is at Stephen F. Austin in East Texas School. And my son, Daniel, is in College Park, Maryland. Mm-hmm. And it's just been a kind of a wild ride. But I'm becoming a vanishing breed or a small breed of ministers who stay in one place for a very long time.
Yeah, there's great advantage to that. And it's a tremendous blessing when people... when the Lord provides. But you're right. I mean, you know, the Lord calls people to different places at different times, but there can also be increasing in the church this idea of careerism, and that's not a good thing. And so to stick around in one place and have a long extended ministry with people, I mean, it almost takes 5 years just to even get to know people, at least in the Midwest, for people to trust you.
Right.
But then beyond there, to have that long, you know, when you're counseling someone who's grieving or going through something difficult, to have a long period, a track record, a shared history is so, it's invaluable. I love your background, and I'm wondering, you know, your movement from, you know, the Baptist world into Presbyterianism. You spoke a bit about your theology of differences and growth in understanding regarding dispensationalism, and no doubt coupled with that would be covenant theology and baptism and all that sort of thing. But what was your understanding early on about the way churches are governed? I'm curious how that comes into the play where you're in law school and then eventually end up in Presbyterian Church in Cleveland, but and then start clerking everything. Was this natural to you, or is this something where you thought all churches did this? I'm curious, what were your thoughts? What was your psychology at the time regarding church order, parliamentary procedure, all that sort of thing?
Yeah. So, I mean, I came into the church, like most people probably, not knowing how the church was run or governed or, you know, what was done. And I think, you know, my background is such that I'm very curious about organization and I have a real desire to help the church mm-hmm. and serve the church. And that was an easy transition for me because I understood church government and things like the Book of Church Order from a perspective of having a career of reading documents and interpreting and applying documents. Mm-hmm. And so that, you know, I was trained to do that. I don't know, you know, most people don't understand law school, when, especially when you go to a place like Michigan, you know, probably 95% of Michigan grads practice outside the state of Michigan. Mm-hmm. They go all over the nation. And so they don't teach you laws. They teach you how to think like a lawyer, to spot problems, to come up with answers, to interpret things. So that's how I was trained. And I was able, again, through God's grace, to apply that into the church. And I enjoy it. And I've always taken to it. And as you may realize, there are a lot of theologians, pastors, ministers who that's foreign to them. They want nothing to do with it. It doesn't interest them. You know, they're glad there's just somebody in their church or on their session yeah. that knows how to deal with those things. Right. And so I'm trying to break that. I teach church polity at RTS at the Houston campus, at the Dallas campus. I taught at Birmingham Theological Seminary this past fall. Wow. And I try to inculcate into folks that it's actually not more holy to be ignorant of governmental principles in our book. And, you know, these are important things because one of the things I tell my class is I don't know of anyone who has had their ministry blow up because they misexegeted Romans 8 mm-hmm. almost everybody has a problem interpersonally, church government, the way they've done things, decisions they've made, mistakes they've made, that really can kill a ministry. And so being aware of the pitfalls and knowing what to do and not doing dumb things is really important for a minister of the gospel. Mm-hmm. And so what I did early on, and I advise young people, and I try to, you know, when I started Camden, like I said, I was 28. I was always the youngest guy in the room. I was always the guy complaining, why do they want to quit this early? Let's go another couple of hours. And now that I'm older, my wife reminds me, you know, that was not very nice. But I just watched, you know, I watched guys like, you know, David Coffin. I watched guys like Harry Reader. You know, I watched guys like John White. I watched guys like Sam Duncan, who, you know, your PCA listeners would know these names.
Yeah, of course.
And I asked questions. You know, I would say afterwards, why'd you do this? And why didn't you do that? And I would, you know, if I had questions as I was studying something in the book or as a question came up in our church, I would, you know, go to people and I would try to learn. And now I find myself on the opposite end of the spectrum. So I probably get conservatively a half dozen calls a week about things. I mean, I had one this morning. Someone said, can we do this? And, you know, how does this work at Presbytery? And, you know, I'm trying to give people principles and try to do that.
Right.
And I enjoy it. As I've said to people, you know, if you were at the General Assembly or you watched the feed, I will verify for you that I was having the time of my life. It was that's really Presbyterian nerdism, but I enjoyed every minute of it. Yeah. And in my mind, that's a way that I can serve the church. And so I've really tried to use what God has given me. I mean, I didn't intend to be a lawyer. He put me there. I didn't intend to know Greek. He gave me that. And I just try to use what he's providentially given me in my life for the kingdom.
Amen. Yeah, and obviously attest to this. I was present as a witness there at the General Assembly in Memphis. I've been 3 years in a row now, even as an OPC interloper. But I can testify that you did not only enjoy your time, but did a tremendous job moderating the assembly. And that is widely recognized throughout the PCA of all sides of the church, that they very much appreciated your moderatorship, your skill, and your adroit way of doing it. So congratulations to that. One also reason I want to talk about these matters so that we can expose this to more people, and we got to make polity cool again, right? Like this isn't just for the nerds. What we're talking about here is based on deep biblical principles. As Presbyterians, we joke that we like to do things decently and in order, but that's a biblical command. These aren't just proclivities or like weird fetishes that we have over rules or something. Like these are actual biblical principles, and we believe that the Lord has given an order to His church that we are to run it, that we are to rule the church according to His word. And so maybe our part, you know, Robert's Rules of Orders is not inspired, but it's certainly conducive to, you know, a biblical way of governing the church. It protects the things that we need to protect.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And I think sometimes people want to take pot shots at Roberts. They act like it's in the way and it's a problem and it's whatever. And really it's applying, just as you said, biblical principles to do things, not just efficiently, but biblically.
Right.
So, you know, as I tell my students, there are two main reasons why we have parliamentary procedure. The first is it allows work to get done without being obstructed. And the second principle that goes along with that is it requires the minority to be able to be heard. The minority has rights to be heard, but it can't completely freeze everything. And so these are two countervailing principles that varying, you know, I won't bore you with every type of motion, but that's at the heart of it in doing that. And I think people don't realize that without parliamentary procedure, we'd be shouting over each other. We would be not listening to each other. We would be using, you know, crude language with each other. You know, as I tell my students, you're not even allowed to say in a meeting, well, you know, as Camden said, you have to say, as the previous speaker said,
right.
And that seems a little stiff and formal, but it's to prevent, kind of personalizing these things.
Takes the heat out of it.
And and I think one of the things that's really been encouraging to me is, and I see this in the PCA, I don't know if you see this in the OP as well, that there's a whole group of young guys who are interested in polity and who are interested in procedure and wanting to do things the right way and help people. I was on another podcast, the Polity Matters podcast, with some of my young friends, and I just enjoyed it. And I often joke that if I'm at a General Assembly, I really don't like when someone stands up at a microphone and says, well, look, you know, I don't really know where we are. I'm not really sure where we're going, but I'd like to try and help. And usually my statement is, sit down. You're not helping. Right. And, you know, people just try to take over meetings. So one of my favorite quips about procedure is there's a motion called a point of personal privilege. Mm. And a lot of people think that that's something like, I want to say what's on my heart.
No.
I have a point of personal privilege. Let me tell you what this means to me. And so there was a time back more than a decade ago, I was sitting in a presbytery meeting. I'm in the pews, and someone stands up and says, you know, I want to make a point of personal privilege. And I wasn't moderating, but I just yelled out, no. And everybody kind of gasped. And I looked at him and I said, are you hot? Right. Are you cold?
Right.
Can you hear the speaker?
Mm-hmm.
And he was like, yeah, I'm fine. I'm like, then you don't have a point of personal privilege. Sit down.
Mm-hmm.
And so there are certain ways that you know, you want the debate to flow along. And one of the things, you know, I've referred to this many times, when I moderate or chair a meeting, I'm a traffic cop. I'm keeping things moving. I don't interject debate. I don't try to put my thumb on the scale. I have an opinion, but I'm counting on other men in the body to express that opinion. I want this to be fair, and I want everyone to be able to have an opportunity to speak. And I think that's biblical, right? To treat each other as brothers, even when we disagree.
Amen. I couldn't agree more. Love that point of personal privilege. That comes up all the time. We get that all the time in the OP. We do often get the speeches or the guy's given a speech and then he's asked, you know, you didn't declare, is this for or against? And he says, I don't know. You know, we get that. It's like, well, thanks for wasting five minutes of our time. That is also an important comment you make about being a moderator. I moderated my presbytery years ago for a 3-year term or so, or thereabouts. I guess it was a 2-year term, and then I had to fill in as interim a couple times. But it's a challenge, and everyone's got an opinion. One of the difficult things is to be faithful and to continue the discussion, keep it moving, being the traffic cop, as you say, but doing so trusting the brothers. Because I find with a lot of maybe type A's, or, you know, everyone's got a thought and something to say. And it's the hardest thing I find in presbytery is just trusting everyone else. And I don't, you know, just because I have a thought doesn't mean that it needs to come out of my mouth on the floor, you know? And so restraint,
right,
and patience and trust in the brothers that this deliberation is working. And if your viewpoint has been said, then that's great. If you're adding something to the conversation, add it. But if you're just repeating because you haven't said whatever you want to say, that's a problem. And so,
right,
so much of it's restraint and trust.
No, that's exactly right.
Yeah.
I think procedure gives that boundary line to that so that it keeps us within bounds, that we don't, you know, little things like you have to speak to the actual motion. You can't take us on a rabbit trail. You know, these things are important to be. I mean, we should be, of all people, Christians should be civil when they disagree.
Yeah.
Even when they have, you know, large standing differences, we should be able to be civil about it.
Mm-hmm. No, I agree. That's part of the value in having Robert's Rules and parliamentary procedure. But even beyond that, I'd love if we could talk about some more denomination specific items, because we use parliamentary procedure in, you know, civic meetings, for example. You can use them in the Rotary Club or something. But we also have even more rules. I believe you have what's called the Rules of Assembly Operations or something, the RAR or RAOR or something of that effect. And we have our rules of our General Assembly and the various policies and procedures in place for doing things. Tell me a bit about that and why it's important not only to just have Robert's Rules, but perhaps even some other structures in place that, again, aren't the inspired word of God, but hopefully based on biblical principles and help us to conduct our matters decently and in order.
Yeah, I think one of the things that's very important about having rules, our RAO, the Rules of Assembly Operation, it means everyone should be able to come into the meeting knowing what to expect, knowing what you need to do, knowing what's possible, if there's changes that need to be made, how they can be made, knowing what your responsibilities are as a committee or the ways in which you can deal with issues. And I think that's exceedingly helpful because you're not at sea. I think that's very important. And there are times, as you said, they're not inspired. And so, they can change. Guilty as charged. I write changes to the RAO and the BCO all the time. The big difference between our book of church order and your book of church order is yours is a hardbound book and ours is a three-ring binder. So you can change things. I think this is important because having some level of certainty as to the process is very helpful and biblical. What people complain about on every level of our society now is if they feel they were treated unfairly because they didn't know the rules or they didn't know what they had to do. And now you can't make everyone read and understand and memorize the rules, but at least the rules apply to everyone equally. And that's Presbyterian,
right?
I mean, I'm moderating the 50th General Assembly and I have the same vote as the brand new seminary graduate who's ordained.
Right.
That's Presbyterianism,
right? Mm-hmm.
We don't have bishops. We don't have, classes of elder. And so I think that is, that's very important as well. And, the other thing that is significant in our day and age is probably different than Presbyterianism a couple hundred years ago, is because the world moves very fast, you can't only take action once or twice a year at an assembly. Mm-hmm. You need mission boards. You need church planning boards. You need, all of these committees. And at the same time, you don't want committees to run the church.
Right.
And so what we in the PCA have done, and you and the OPC have done it a little bit different, but it's the same principle. Mm-hmm. It's the same in the ARP. It's the same in the RPCNA. And is, we have a way for our annual meeting of the General Assembly or of, the wider church to oversee the actions of, I'm going to use a bad word here, but it's not bad, the bureaucracy, the folks who are involved, full time in that kind of ministry throughout the year. And I'm thankful for them, right? I don't want our mission work to only go on 1 week a year. I want it to go 52 weeks a year. And, but I don't want it to go on without oversight. And so that's a very important part of our rules. It allows for oversight, but it doesn't jam everything up. And again, everyone knows what's expected. That's really a large part of what our assembly does. We really do two things. We oversee the general work of the church throughout the year, mm-hmm. and then we deal with what are called overtures. And that's, specific resolutions that are brought by presbyteries each year. They might be amendments to the Constitution. We had one that was of some significance. We passed an overture to have me as the moderator appoint a commission to write a letter to governmental entities expressing our disagreement with and concern about transgender surgery and medical interventions for minors. Kind of a very narrow issue, but an important issue, right? It wasn't broadly about identity and it wasn't broadly about higher education. It was about something that clearly the Bible speaks against mm-hmm. and our standards speak against. So we have sometimes things like that, and then sometimes there's broader constitutional issues. But all in all, this would be impossible without structure and rules, especially for us. Because as you know, our assembly is like, multi times the size of yours. We've been averaging about 2,100, 2,200 commissioners.
Right.
And I think you guys are in like the 200s, right?
150-ish. Yeah, about 150 commissioners.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it's hard to keep that many people in line.
Yeah. Yeah, there's all sorts of differences. I mean, even in the rules, you know, when I attended the Overtures Committee, it very much was reminiscent of our General Assembly, because we have a commissioned assembly, something a delegated assembly, but we call our participants commissioners, right? Because some people might make a distinction. I don't know if this is a valid distinction. I use it, but a commissioner is someone that votes according to their own conscience, not necessarily the will of the body that sent them. Yeah. But regardless, they're representing, they're one of, you know, people that have been sent by their presbytery or their church. So there's all sorts of interesting stuff here. I love your comment also about our Book of Church Order being a hard bound book. That's true. We do change it on occasion, but even when we do change it, we have a rule that it can only be reprinted in years ending in 0 or 5. So because it costs too much to print a hardcover book every year. So we do have some pending changes that haven't seen the light of day, that won't until 2025, and kind of waiting for those to come around because they're not in effect yet. But you got to do these things. And there's nothing wrong with this. This is voluntary because of, you know, the Bible doesn't say thou shalt publish rules in a hard bound book, but we decide to do things this way. And there are ways of changing those rules if we need to. And the biggest thing perhaps that's important is that all of this is available. We publish everything. There is no secrets. There's no hiding. And everyone knows how things ought to work. And we keep ourselves accountable to one another like that. Fred, do you teach your new members these types of things? When I, you know, was, you know, I'm still a minister serving in my church, but I'm not working at the church day in and day out and doing a lot of new members classes. But when I did, I always would point people to our Book of Church Order and explain to them their rights and privileges and how things worked. I didn't make them read it all, but I said, look, but if anything comes about, if you find your brother stumbling or you are encountered, we encounter you with some issue, here's all your rights. They're right here. We're not hiding. There's no secrets. Everything you want to know is in this book right here. Were you ever, I mean, what did you do to teach people or to share this information with perhaps new believers, or at least people who are transferring into your congregation?
I try to, especially in what we call our Introduction to Christ Church class. It's not quite a new members class, yeah, but it's like it. I try to give people a sense of church government, and I talk to them about the differences between Congregationalism and Episcopalianism and Presbyterianism, and what that looks like and how it applies. And I talk in a general way about complaints and appeals, in a sense that, you know, if you don't feel like you're getting a fair shake, so to speak, there's accountability built into Presbyterianism. That's another wonderful thing about that form of government and doing that. I let people know about the Book of Church Order. I don't, you know, give them copies of Robert's Rules, although, you know, they know that I know these things, mm-hmm, and they know that it's, you know, dear to my heart. And so if they have questions, you know, they will come probably more than the average minister will get. I'll get asked questions about these sorts of things. You know, it's I have a lot of fun. So after I moderated, a friend of mine who's a PCA pastor up your way in Illinois, in Chicagoland area, Joe Christman.
Yeah.
Sent me a leather bound copy of Robert's Rules of Order.
I saw the pictures.
And so he got it from a Bible binding company, and they put it together. And so I'll often joke with people, if they're arguing Roberts with me, I'll look at them and say, do you have a leather bound copy of Roberts? I don't think so. Anyway, so my people know I have a passion for that, and they don't feel bad about asking me. And sometimes they're just curious, you know. And one of the things I try to do, which I would encourage every minister in every denomination, is when an assembly is over, and this is, I've done this 17 years, so it's not just when I moderate, I spend usually one entire evening service giving an update and a report on the General Assembly, talking about all our various committees, talking about how the assembly works, because there's always new people, talking about what the big issues were, how we voted, et cetera, to give them a sense of the broader church. Because I think it's important for Presbyterian members to realize they're Presbyterian.
Right.
And the church is bigger than their local church.
Right.
And that should be encouraging. And that should be a source of benefit and blessing. Mm-hmm. And so I make every effort to do that, you know, every year. I also write and that's some to some degree, and that's available, you know, to our folks. I did a series of videos with Dr. Dominic Aquila about our Book of Church Order.
Yeah.
And yeah, I all the time I hear from usually ruling elders because their ministers, you know, tell them to watch these because it's helpful in learning about how do you plan a church? How, you know, what's a complaint? How do you do a trial? You know, what's an elder? What's a deacon? And again, I'm just trying to serve the church because these are the men laboring in their fields and doing, you know, it for the Lord and doing a good job. And I'm glad for them. And if I can help them be more productive in their calling, I want to do that.
Amen.
And so some of my church members, not all of them, have watched the videos and, you know, they'll get an insight, you know, with that. I just really enjoy teaching people about church government and polity because practically speaking, it's very significant.
Yeah.
I mean, it doesn't come up in my church whether Jesus is God. I mean, it comes up in a sermon, but there's nobody arguing in my church that Jesus is not God. There's nobody arguing in my church that the Bible isn't inspired. Now, both of those things are much more important than church government, much more important. But people don't understand church government. They don't understand their rights, like you're saying. They don't understand their responsibilities.
Right.
And so I find that instructing people in that is very helpful.
Amen. I couldn't agree more. And again, this is not just stuff for the nerds or for a couple experts to run the meetings. This ought to be for everyone to some degree because it applies to everyone. Fred, in our time remaining, I got a few PCA type questions. I'd like to get some reflection from you. I've been doing in the last couple of years, getting to know a lot of PCA brothers. I do know Joe. We get together every couple months. So I wish I could have him up more frequently. And I love the PCA. You know, the OPC is my mother, and I'm in the OPC as long as the OPC exists. But we have the highest ecumenical fellowship that we can have, and I like it that way. But I've been reading also a lot more recently about histories. I have David Hall's new history on the PCA. I believe it's titled Irony in the Presbyterian Church in America. I'll be speaking with David in a couple weeks on the podcast about that. I was even today reading the forthcoming issue of the Confessional Presbyterian Journal, which has all sorts of articles that are focusing on the 50th anniversary of the Presbyterian Church in America, which was just celebrated in December. There's an article in there by Scott Cook on the formation of the Standing Judicial Committee. Zach Groff had one in there surveying a bunch of different issues. There's some on confessional subscription, and there's great stuff. But reflecting now, you're the moderator of the 50th General Assembly, also coinciding with the 50th anniversary. That isn't always the case. The OPC is off right now, so we've had more assemblies than we've had anniversaries. But for you, the 50th and the 50th here are coinciding. Do you have any circumspect thoughts or comments, perhaps, on the development of the PCA over time? We've been speaking about church order, rules, governance, parliamentary procedure. It hasn't always been that way. I'm not saying it used to be bad and now it's good or vice versa, but there's been development. Do you have any thoughts on the changes over time and maybe where the church might be going into the future?
Yeah, I've now been in the PCA just about half my life. So I'm 54 and came into the PCA a little bit more than 27 years ago. And the headline is I am very bullish on the PCA. I've not always been. As you know, when the PCA was founded in the early 70s, the PCA was not nearly as distinctively reformed as the OPC was and is. Mm. It was really a product of evangelical fundamental, and I use that in the best, yeah, you know, five fundamentals right way, Christians who were fighting liberalism, real liberalism, like Jesus isn't God liberalism, the resurrection isn't true liberalism. And it had taken a toll because, of course, you know, the OPC was formed four decades earlier. Mm-hmm. So if I can put it this way, the rot rotted a lot longer in the mainline church, the PCUS. And so there were dispensationalists, there were Baptists. I know that's hard to believe, but there were, you know, people who had Baptistic leanings. But they were all agreed on the major issues of the faith, you know, Christ, the Bible, salvation, the Holy Spirit, the Trinity, covenantal theology to a good extent. And anyway, the PCA has, I think, become more and more reformed over the decades. Our ministers initially were all trained at like Columbia. Mm-hmm. And now I would say probably the vast majority of PCA ministers are trained either at RTS or at Westminster, Philadelphia, or at Westminster, California, or at Greenville, or maybe at Mars. And there's maybe a few Southern guys, but they're trained at confessional seminaries.
Right.
And that's made a gigantic difference over 30 years, an incredible difference. Mm. And so I see the PCA becoming more and more committed to confessional biblical Presbyterianism.
Mm-hmm.
I know that I don't want to get into all the controversy about subscription, but, you know, in the main, you know, we've got probably more exceptions to the confession that we approve that I would want, but we're not taking massive exceptions. They're the same kind of few over and over again. And this is becoming more and more obvious. And, you know, one of the things I think it's ironic how the Lord uses things. There was the great controversy about Revoice and about Memorial Prez in St. Louis and about one of our ministers. And it really was a wake-up call for the PCA. So people think the PCA has shifted since that controversy. It hasn't. What happened is we hosted General Assembly in Houston, and I think it was 2013. And there were something like 750 commissioners. Last year, I think there were 2,200 commissioners. Yeah. The PCA has not tripled in size.
Mm-hmm.
We don't have a delegated assembly like y'all right. do. We have the Overtures Committee is our version of that,
right?
Mm-hmm. So every teaching elder can be a commissioner, and every church, if they have 10 members, can send two ruling elders. And then as you have 350 members and 850 members, you get additional ruling elders.
Mm-hmm.
If every potential commissioner came, it would be something like a 10,000 commissioner assembly. So what we've seen is greater participation in the PCA, more small church pastors, many more ruling elders. You know, when the PCA was first formed, the first assembly had more ruling elders than teaching elders. And then at the low point, I think we had under 20% of the assembly was ruling elders.
Wow.
And at the last few assemblies, it's been more like 30% plus. That's a significant change. And so what we're seeing is, I think, broader participation. And what we're seeing is a greater sense of what the PCA is. And so, for example, we've dealt, I think, very well with the issues of sexuality. I mean, I would commend to you and your listeners our human sexuality report that was written by Kevin DeYoung and Tim Keller and Brian Chappell and some others. And it's just a wonderful, we really need it. Now, you and I wouldn't think we would need to revisit the issue of concupiscence, but we did. You know, this is like a reformational issue, right? But we lost our way. And now we've actually got good, solid theology, quoting John Owen, you know, quoting John Calvin right. on these issues. So we've become much tighter on things like that. We're trying to deal with things like abuse in the church environment. And I think not to the satisfaction of everyone, but I think we're doing a very good job. We passed some changes last year. You know, at the assembly, there was all this talk in the news about things we didn't do. And no one talked about what we did do to protect witnesses, to protect abuse victims in the process. And I'm very glad to be seeing that. And, you know, I had many, many close friends that about 8 or 6 years ago were saying to me, you know, we need to leave. We need to form another new denomination. And I said, you know, no, I don't think it's time. And, you know, I had a personal stake in a Camden because usually the undertone of that was, and you can be the state clerk
right.
and you can set up the mission board and, you know, you're administratively gifted. You secretaried everything. You just, you don't have to do everything, but you can set it all up. No, I don't want to do that. I want a pastor. I don't have anyone saying that now.
Yeah.
And this one of the blessings of being the last moderator was we had one of the most unified assemblies that I've ever seen. We had so many votes that were overwhelming. And even the few that were really controversial, the debate was not snarky. It was not harsh. It was not difficult. It was very respectful. It was informative. And so I think we're in a very good place. I'm very happy about, you know, where the PCA is. And that's important because, as you know, we live in a culture right now that's becoming more and more hostile to the church.
Yeah. Hopefully, you know, I've got Aaron Wren's new book, but he's talking about the church in the negative world. And his principle there is you know, it's really kind of unprecedented, at least for the last 1,000+ years, for the church to not be accepted. I mean, the world has always been opposed to Christ and his kingdom. But there's always been this, for a long time, a veneer where Christians were at least seen as, you know, civically minded, good people to have around, hardworking, those types of things. Right. And now we're not just seen as, you know, maybe religious weirdos, but good citizens. Now we're seen as, you know, contrary and enemies of what is right in their mind. You know, what is, because they present virtue, which is really no virtue at all. And so you're right. But I'm delighted to hear that report. I share that assessment with you, even though I'm somewhat an outsider, but as a brother in Christ, and I couldn't be happier at the trends in the PCA, and hope those things continue, and that there is just a wonderful joint effort of all confessional bodies, whether OPC, PCA, and even we get out into the continental tradition, all through NAPARC and ICRC throughout the world. We want to see more and more of this, and see growth and flourishing. Because Christ has promised to care for his church, and he's going to do that. I'm going to maybe wrap things up. I want to, but I'm tempted. I'm going to lean into my temptation here. You got any hot takes? I'll ask you two things. You can pass on this entirely, or we can cut this out of the episode entirely. And I'm like one sentence responses. Any thoughts on witnesses in court trials? That came up at the PCA General Assembly. Should unbelievers be allowed to be a witness in a church trial? And whether or not here's the real hot one, the DPW ought to be part of the BCO and constitutionally binding. Is this too hot to handle?
So the first one, I have never been bothered by the fact that we don't allow unbelievers to testify.
Sure.
You know, people act like it's, I think, a bigger deal than it is, because, you know, you could take a statement to the police by, you know, the classic example is you don't take the maid's statement. She saw someone being abused. Well, if she submits that to the police, it's a doc. You can be admitted.
Right. So you can still hear the information. You can receive the information.
That's right. Now, I will say I haven't given it a lot of thought, so I'll leave you in suspense when I produce my annual document about overtures to the assembly. But there is an overture number one, that's seeking to change that. And it's interesting, that was passed, and then some folks were critical of it, and then went back and revisited it and changed it a bit. So I don't have a firm opinion yet, but there's a sense in which maybe there can be some middle ground there, and that can be found. We'll see. What I don't want us to do is I don't want us to change our fundamental principles of justice and trials simply to try to achieve a result. Mm-hmm. I don't want us to do that at all. Now, on the on our directory of worship, we have this kind of patchwork. We have a couple of chapters and one paragraph on marriage that are constitutional.
Correct. You're right. I'm aware of that.
And everything else isn't. Mm-hmm. And the big debate now is one other chapter about preaching. And right now I'm leaning toward yes to that, because preaching is so central, and I don't see anything in that chapter that is not done. The interesting thing, though, is this is much more true probably of the PCA than the OPC. There are huge sections of our directory of worship that are derived from historical directories, including Westminster, that just aren't done in our churches. You know, there are statements about frequently singing psalms that are just not done in PCA churches. They're done in my church, but not in PCA churches. So what I wouldn't want us to do is to make something binding and then wink, wink, it doesn't really count.
Right.
We're not expecting people to follow it. that would, I think, be worse mm-hmm. than not having it. So I don't see the whole directory being made constitutional at one swath, but I can see certain sections that make sense. Like, for example, what we have now is baptism and the Lord's Supper and marriage. And I think preaching is another big one, too. I'm not sure that we would need to have provisions on like giving
right.
be constitutional,
right?
Right? And how the offering is to be taken.
Yeah, no, that's wise. I appreciate that. I didn't mean to put you on the spot, but I appreciate you thinking on your feet, as you mentioned, as an attorney, sharing with it. Yeah, these are important topics. And as I'm talking to other PCA friends and even, you know, seeing the hubbub on Twitter X, you know, mutual acquaintance or friend of ours, Scott Edberg, who now is in Illinois, he almost got canceled on Twitter because he was suggesting some of this stuff. So it was all somewhat humorous, but these are important matters. So I'm curious to see what comes along. Where can people like me or anyone listening stay up to date with these things? Do you have any suggestions for further resources, either to read or to follow along, you know, for in general? But maybe even with specifics looking forward to the 51st General Assembly.
So typically speaking, if you we have an electronic magazine, By Faith.
Yep.
They tend to cover, they just put out their first article about the overtures that are out so far. The Gospel Reformation Network puts out articles about upcoming issues, et cetera. You know, Twitter usually is a good place to find links to articles. You know, Scott Edberg, Spreadberg, as we call him, Jared Nelson in Western Pennsylvania. You know, there's a lot of folks. Yeah. Josh Torres here in Texas with me, mm-hmm. And the folks at PresbyCast, you know, mm-hmm. the various podcasts in doing that. You know, as we get closer to assembly, I may make the rounds of some of those podcasts. And then I haven't really ever officially posted it, but usually anyone who wants to can get a copy of each year, except for last year. I produce my thoughts on the matters before the assembly. I do it intentionally, knowing that they're going out publicly. It's not really intended to be partisan or tell people how to vote. It's just what I intend to do. And, you know, oftentimes I'll propose amendments that I'm going to propose in committee or on the floor, in doing that. And so, you know, it'll probably not be until about March or April, but then you'll start to see a lot of stuff on social media and in the various websites, you know, hot and heavy.
Yeah.
We've only got, I think, about 6 or 7 overtures so far. So we're probably due for another 20 or so in the next, in the next couple of months. I know I've got at least 3 or 4 in my mind to write, and I haven't had a chance to write them yet. So we'll see.
Well, we'll look forward to all the good stuff coming up, and certainly we'll post all the links that are necessary in our episode description and make sure people are aware of these resources for the future. Fred, this has been a really wonderful conversation. We'd love to have you back soon sometime, but hopefully I can get down to Houston in, you know, maybe even this year. Probably not for another national championship soon, but it's been a pleasure. Thanks for taking the time today, and I really wish you the best in the Lord.
Well, appreciate your time and the opportunity to be here. And yeah, come on down. I'll take you out for a big Texas steak.
Let's do it. That or barbecue. I love it. But we'll put the links in the episode description. Follow along at reformforum.org for more information about all of our programs, courses, upcoming events, etc. And I do want to thank everybody for listening and for watching. We hope you join us again next time on Christ the Center.